All right, Book of Esther. Got two more classes. We'll hit chapter 7 and 8 this week and 9 and 10 next week. I should button her up. A quick recap. Haman, he was way up here, and he is slowly on a quick route down. He was on top of the world thinking he had these Jews licked. Finally, he would have peace and contentment with Mordecai strung up, and he would find joy in that with all, not only Mordecai, but all the Jews destroyed. That quickly was falling apart. It's strange how that can happen in life. Life changes fast. It really does. Esther, she stepped out in faith, and she invited the king and Haman to a second banquet where she is going to make known Haman's plot, and basically his plot to turn in all the Jews. A lot rides on this. Mordecai, he was an average Jew in the king's court, and now he had been all the way lifted up to a man the king would like to honor, paraded around the kingdom for, you know, basically by Haman. funny how that worked out. All for just doing the right thing at the right time. He didn't do this for any sort of reward. There was no sign posted, hey, if you do, you know, make sure you watch over the king, you'll get riches and rewards. He did it because it was the right thing to do. And mind you, Xerxes was far from a great king. Mordecai just did it because it was right, not the reward or any praise from men. So let's turn to Esther chapter 7, we'll read 1 through 6. The king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther, the queen. The king said to Esther, on the second day also as they drank wine at the banquet, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even half the kingdom, it shall be done. Queen Esther replied, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, if it pleases the king, let my life be given to me as my petition. My people ask my request. For we've been sold, and my people, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Now, if we'd only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurable with annoyance to the king. King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is he who has performed? Who would presume to do thus? Esther said, a foe and an enemy is the wicked Haman. Haman's face just fell off. Haman became terrified before the king and the queen. You know, his day just couldn't get any worse. It was just going downhill on a freight train. One of the things about Esther, though, as she comes and even goes before the king here, this is actually going to be the third time the king says, up to half the kingdom. And he's basically saying, Esther, I love you way more than anybody else in the kingdom. You are the most valuable person to me in the kingdom. And here, though, we see more of Esther's strengths. And this was something the world would actually say is a weakness, and that is humility. The humility, the humble, blessed are the humble, blessed are those that just walk around with their faces down. That wasn't Esther at all. Esther was a very humble person, but she also knew who she was. What humility means is really not to assume anything, not to assume power, not to assume, it doesn't mean you're a doormat. It means that you don't assume anything. And she didn't. Esther never demanded anything, as we saw that throughout her life. And that's because she put 100% of her trust in God. And if you think about it, yeah, she really didn't have much to put trust in. I mean, the only person I think she knew as she went through life that really cared about her was Mordecai. And he had looked out for her, but she'd been put in a really weird situation. This is about 4.5 years into into her reign as queen. I'm sure it's been a wild 4.5 years. trusting in God requires, and is basically another fruit of the Spirit. Trust and faith go hand in hand. And so does patience. See, pride says, I am the greatest, I know all, and thus no one needs to advise me of anything. And have you ever known anybody who's probably fairly wealthy? The ones that I've known in life, they're nice people, but only a handful of them are actually patient. And the uber wealthy, those in the billion dollar club and above, they're not very patient at all. Because they're used to having everything at a moment's notice. Having it right there. So wealthy people, they're patient and they aren't humble. They kind of go hand in hand. It's a culture where everything centers around them. As I said before, some of the Ubers out there, you know, Elon Musk, who's going to tell him he's wrong? People don't do that. They have a culture where everything revolves around them. And really, you ever wonder about why it's so hard for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God? Because they're constantly told they're right. They're wealthy, so they must have done something right. And so why would they ever humble themselves to God or to Jesus or any of that? You know, that's why it's so hard for the rich to enter the kingdom of God, because they aren't going to realize that they're missing something, that really everything that they have built their life upon is a sham, it's false, it's just a facade that's out there, and they're going to die and they're going to lose it anyhow, and they need to humble themselves to a greater power, to a greater being, that would be God and Jesus Christ. Rich people are self-absorbed. If you want any proof of it, I'll give you a couple things. Who's heard of global warming? Okay, we've heard of global warming, right? You stick your head in the ground and think there's global warming. And I don't really buy into that. I think it's all just a woohoo. It's a sine wave going up and down, warming and cooling. In the 70s, they have National Geographic that say global cooling on them. Watch out for that. But global warming is a big trend, right? And a lot of the tech guys, they're flaming liberals, and they kind of buy into that as well. Jeff Bezos, you know, I know he's definitely a liberal, and I think he buys into that. He built this new yacht. It's a $500 million yacht. It burns 230 gallons of fuel every hour. Does that sound very conservative? That's insane how much fuel that takes. Bill Gates, he's very big into climate, population control and all of that. He flew last year, get this, 392 flights in his private plane, which is a Gulfstream, a really big plane. 392 flights. Obviously multiple flights in a day to rack that up. You know, that's insane. You can imagine how much jet fuel that burn off. He claims to offset it by spending $7 million on his carbon footprint. But, you know, you can spend $7 million on your carbon footprint, but you're still putting carbon dioxide and all that garbage in the air. But here's the thing. Who's going to go to Jeff Bezos and say, you probably should save on that gas? Or, why don't you cut a couple of those flights out, Bill? Nobody. Nobody. The people around them are all yes people. They're going to say, good job, Bill. Keep it up, Jeff. Money and power, those things fly in the face of spiritual things. And that gets back to why that rich man can't enter the kingdom of God. And that also shows why Haman was going off the rails and Esther is still just doing what she's always done. Being patient, waiting on God, trusting in God. Esther was patient because she had to be. Like I said earlier, she spent about 4.5 years married to Xerxes, a man that, per the historical record, he really wasn't a great guy. You know, there's nothing in the historical record that says Xerxes was a good dude. Esther trusted, and she was thrust into this marriage. We might look at that. Hey, Esther's queen. You know, her idea of a dream life was shattered when she got married to him. You know, he had a harem and she was not going to have that doting husband that maybe she dreamed of when she was younger. So Esther, you know, really had to trust in the Lord. And that patience allowed her to step back and see God's plan really unfold. And that goes the same with you and me. Anyone ever mess things up by rushing and trying to control it yourself? I have. I'll flat out say I have. I've blown in here and there, and I'm like, why don't I just wait? Okay? Patience is something we, most everybody struggles with a little bit. Jump over to 2 Peter chapter 3. Verses 8 and 9. But do not let this one fact escape your notice, beloved, that with the Lord one day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years like one day. The Lord is not slow about his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient toward you, not wishing for any to perish, but for all to come to repentance. You know, it's very easy to think, gee, Lord, is anything ever going to happen? Well, maybe God just, you know, giving it some time to work itself out. You know, this whole thing with Esther and Mordecai, we're talking 4.5 years. I know I personally have been caught in the trap of jumping. This is a classic example. You know, I try to stay out of Walmart, probably because this is my weakness. If I'm in the grocery line, there's a shorter line, and I'll go to that line. And you get in that line, and all of a sudden, you know, you've got the sloth doing the scanning. And then all of a sudden, they have a price check and can't figure out what the price of this thing is. And they dial it up, you know, trying to put it in their computer, trying to figure out what the price is. And that long line is just cruising. Could have been through it twice by now. Okay, that's a classic example of where being patient, hey, just let it work itself out. A lot of times, it'll work in your favor. Time is 100% irrelevant to God. He doesn't care about time. He cares about righteousness and holiness. And if that's going to take a while with you, me, or anybody else, so be it. He's okay with that. To man, with our fixed lives, we plan everything around time. We really do, don't we? I mean, we try to jam as much as we can in the 70, 80, whatever years we have here. I mean, we do that. We know that our time is fixed. If our time wasn't fixed, hey, I'll just goof off today, so I'll get another bunch of these tomorrow. I can put it off to tomorrow because I got lots of tomorrows. But that's not how it really works. Like I said, God is interested in righteousness, justice, and holiness. And almost all of that, when working with a human being and in a human condition, takes time. Joseph had to be patient as God worked through the years. I think, you know, my take is it's probably about 10 years from when he first got, you know, chucked by his brothers till he actually became second in command in Egypt. I think that's how it works out. But he had to be time. We can read through that account fairly quickly, but if you live that, 10 years can be a long time, especially when you're 17 years old and chucked in the bottom of a pit. But that's what God decided it was going to take. Okay, who was Joseph to argue? And where did he end up? Second in command of Egypt. See, patience and faith goes hand in hand. Because if you aren't faithful, I guarantee you won't be patient. Why would you be? You don't have anything really to have faith in. Esther had full faith in God, and thus she could be patient and let his plan unfold. So Esther's moment to spill the beans arrives. And she lets the king know there was Haman who was the enemy, and Haman was the one who had set this plot in motion. And ultimately, Haman was going to lead to the death and destruction of all the Jews. One thing's interesting. We don't see her outright where she goes, "And I'm a Jew." But you can see from the wording that clearly she's saying, "I and my people." She identifies with the Jews. And it's clearly revealed to the king that she is a Jew. And a side note, even in her defense and revealing, we see her character comes out. You know, she says, we had just been sold into the hard, sold, it wouldn't really be worth bothering the king. What do you think the king would have said if he found out that Haman had sold his queen into basically hard labor? I think we'd have blown a stop there too. But she probably knew that. She knew how this was going to play out. But again, it's that humble spirit that really speaks to Xerxes and to the situation. But it shows her patient character, and it's the default behavior. Haman's day doesn't get any worse. His reaction to all of this, he becomes terrified before the king and the queen. Jump to Proverbs 26. Verse 27. Though his hatred covers itself with guile, his wickedness will be revealed before the assembly. You ever look out there and wonder, man, why don't these wicked people ever get exposed? They do a lot of times. But it just takes time. Haman has dug himself... I got the wrong verse. 27. He who digs a pit will fall into it. He rolls a stone, it will come back on him. That makes more sense. You know, Haman had dug himself a pit. That stone is coming right back on him. And that's a lot of times what happens. You know how they figure out if people lie? They ask them multiple times. The feds do this. Okay, give me the story. Give me the story again. Give me the story again. Because you'll see little subtle differences start showing up in what is being, in what the person is saying. It's hard to be consistent with lies. But truth, it always comes out. And Haman's plan was just a web of lies. He had an elaborate plan to put Mordecai to death, and now it's his own life that is in jeopardy. The wise always think they're one step ahead until they aren't. And that's again what happens with tunnel vision. You know, Haman had this view. I can't be wrong. It's all working out great. I can't be wrong. I. You know, how could he be wrong? And with this tunnel vision focused on himself, he totally misses what's happening around him. Another danger of, you know, getting self-focused. And we see that in the world today. You see a lot of, most people are self-focused. That's part of the reason our country is really struggling. You know, if we thought more of other people, we wouldn't have a lot of the moral problems. We definitely wouldn't have the economic problems. Why does everybody need money from the government? You know, and we send it to other, I mean, it's stupid. And most of our government, unfortunately, is self-focused. Okay, it's just a train wreck that happens when everyone is obsessed with themselves. If you doubt it, go on to Facebook. Well, don't go on Facebook because I won't. But the number one thing people do on Facebook is selfies. I mean, selfie, that didn't even exist when I was a kid, that term. You know, what is it? I think it's funny. Yeah, we're self-focused. If Haman were alive today, I bet Haman would have more selfies than anybody on Facebook. Because his life was all about him. So, but Esther, she's a picture of faith. And one thing about Esther's faith, and it's how God works, you have to act in faith, right? But who did the work? God. But it takes both. God doesn't act by himself. Esther acted in concert with God. God did a lot of work here, right? But Esther had to move forward to get the ball rolling. You know, it's the same all throughout the scriptures. David, he had to grab some smooth stones. Couldn't God have just, you know, zot, taken out Goliath? Sure he could have. But it was David's faith that God stepped in and worked through David. And by working with God, what do you think that did to David's faith picture? It made it even stronger than it was. Elijah, he was on the Battle of Mount Carmel. He built an altar and sacrificed it on Mount Carmel to prove the false obstacles were just that, false and useless. Did he have to build an altar? Could God not have just boomed from the skies and thundered and said something? He could have. Okay, but God, every single time in the scriptures, you'll see God working through people. Because that's what God wants to see. He wants to see people acting. Because when people act in faith, other than a big light show, it shows people have faith in God. It shows that you can have faith in God. And when you have faith in God and others see that, what does that do? Attracts them to you. That really shows God's power. God's power is shown more working through you than any lightning show out there. That's really what God wants to see for us. He wants to see us out there stepping out in faith. The book of Esther required the faith of Mordecai and Esther, an example of what God is looking for in his people today. James make it really clear, faith without works is dead. And where does that work? Is that us doing it all ourselves? No, it doesn't even take a whole lot, honestly. Esther was just faithful. She was just faithful to stand up and speak up for her people. That's all she really did. Okay? But God really honored that. Esther lays it out here that Haman's plot and all the damaging chaos that it's going to cause. Esther did a masterful job of building things up to this point when she reveals who he came and is and what he did. The king, like I say, was pretty much in the palm of her hand. And again, everything that she had done paid off. She needed this big build-up because what Esther is asking for is a big ask. See, even though the idea to kill all the Jews, that was Haman's idea, right? But who was the one who signed it into law? Xerxes. That's the big problem that we're seeing right here. It was all Haman's idea, But nothing happens without the king's signature. If we remember back there, Haman said, I'll give you a bunch of money paid in the king's treasury if you'll sign this into law. And, you know, Xerxes just kind of, sure, whatever, and signed it into law. And so the unfortunate thing is it was put together by Haman, but Xerxes' signature was on the line. And that is a big problem. You know, he's the king. He can do whatever he wants, right? Well, he can, but he's also a king that history says is extremely prideful. And so for him to admit, I was wrong, this is a bad idea, that's a problem. So it's going to take a lot to get this thing reversed. Did God know this? Of course. So God is going to keep this plan moving. Jump back to Esther. Read 7 through 10. The king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was fallen on the couch where Esther was. The king said, "Will even assault the queen with me in the house?" As word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbonah, I was almost said Harbaugh, too much Michigan football. Then Harbonah, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, "Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king." The king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which had been prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. So we don't exactly know the king's state at this point. We know he'd been drinking some wine, so who knows, maybe he was a little tipsy. But one thing we do know is he was mad. His anger was on full display. He was upset. And rightly so. His queen, and one that he actually cared about, could end up dead, and his basically vice president or whatever had got the whole thing in motion. So he leaves the room to ponder this and figure out what to do. And he's got a couple problems. He can admit he made a mistake by signing this law and decree to eliminate the Jews. Or he can lose his precious wife that three times he said we could have half the kingdom for. He's got rock, hard place. Here's Xerxes. So he takes some time away to process and kind of figure out where to do. And where's God? Well, he's right in the middle of all this. He knows what's going on. Haman's character is on full display. It's crazy that he would even believe for a second that Esther would help him out. But he's a manipulator. He works situations. He works people to try to get what he wants. So he thinks. So he has nowhere else to turn. So he turns to Esther to try to beg her for his life. I'm not, like I say, not sure what he thought that would do, but Hail Mary's sometimes better than nothing at all. Jump to Psalm 110. We're just going to read the first couple of verses. Psalm 110. The Lord said to my Lord, "Sit in my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet." The Lord will stretch forth your long scepter from Zion, saying, "Rule in the midst of your enemies." So Haman has been the Jews' enemies. And God is making sure he knows this, that Haman knows where he is at. And he's begging for his life at the feet of Esther. God will be victorious. And again, if you take anything from tonight, take away, God will be victorious, but it might take some time. His timing is always perfect there, because right here, the tables are turned, and it's now Haman's whose life is in jeopardy. This next part is super duper interesting, because how exactly did this play out? How did Haman end up looking like he was assaulting the queen? I'm not entirely sure. You can kind of, you know, again, we don't have a lot there, so you kind of got to put your imagination in it. Did he come to beg, please, Esther, and tripped? You know, that's how I look at it. That's really about the only way I could see this thing, how this thing played out. He approached the queen, and maybe the wine was kicking in, and maybe he's a little antsy, realizing his life could be going away, be on the line. But anyhow, somehow he ends up landing on the queen. And this is at the precise moment that Xerxes enters the room. And this is exactly one of those things. Can God control Haman's mind, Esther, or the king? No, he can't go in and control their mind, control their will, do anything like that. God gives everyone free will. Can he make somebody trip? Sure. He can do that. And that's exactly what happens right here. And he does it, God has this happen at exactly the right time. Did it look like Haman was actually assaulting the queen? I don't know, and you know what? I don't think it was going to take a lot. I think Xerxes just said, perfect excuse. Great way. Now I can get rid of this troublesome guy, Haman. I can get him out of here, and I know, and problem solved. Xerxes was a cunning guy. That is, history will say that. And he saw a perfect opportunity to basically clean up the problem that was Haman. Haman was a witness to Xerxes signing the decree to destroy the Jews. And one of the first things you do if you want to cover something up is get rid of the witnesses. And so Haman's gone. This is a great opportunity for him to do this. Assaulting the queen was a great excuse to execute Haman. Problem solved, Haman's out of the picture. And this again, could God have struck Haman with lightning? Could he have had a heart attack and just boop, died on the spot? Yeah, he could have. But God used people and their faith, even godless people such as Xerxes, to accomplish his real will. Not saying Xerxes had faith, but God used Xerxes to get rid of Haman. And we finish up the chapter, Haman is getting hung on the gallows that ultimately he had built for himself, for Mordecai. The wicked ended up getting trapped by his own snare. Do you have a comment, Dave?
One thing I noticed, too, is that just before the banquet that Esther put on earlier that day, Haman was set to lead Mordecai through the city wearing the king's robe because of earlier events. Yep. And that really played a part in all this, too, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that really, Haman had lots of things that built up a lot of animosity, obviously, and really messed with his head. So, yeah, definitely true. Yeah, so the wicked, they end up getting trapped in their own snare. It's a very common occurrence. Mr. Serrano.
Sorry, I'm not trying to derail, but I was just thinking about when Jesus said, you know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword, and New Testament scripture talking about the measuring stick you use to judge others will be used against you. And I think it's very fitting with Haman and his story.
Oh, yeah, it's all true. And we think we can get away from this stuff. We think, especially the wealthy, the wise in their own eyes, whatever you want to put it there, they think, so much of the world thinks they can get away from God's view, laws, whatever you want to put there. But they can't. They all end up getting trapped in it. It does, and time and again, we see this. And it's going to happen to U.S. of A. Hopefully, we figure it out before it happens. You know, but God will take care of those that are faithful, just like he did in Esther. Did you have another comment, Dave? Oh, okay. Yeah, the rulers of this world really think they have a lot more figured out than they do. Let's jump back to Esther. Let's move on to chapter 8. Haman's out of the picture. He was hung on the gallows that were prepared for Mordecai. Fell into basically his own trap. Let's read 8:1-7. On that day, King Xerxes gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Esther spoke again to the king and fell at his feet, wept and implored him to avert the evil schemes of Haman the Agagite, and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. The king extended the golden scepter to Esther, so Esther arose and stood before the king. Then she said, "If it pleases the king, if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the calamity which will befall my people? How can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?" So King Xerxes said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they have hanged in the gallows which he had stretched out his hand against the Jews." The tables have totally flipped here. All the house of Haman is now given to Esther. So not only did they hang Haman up, but they gave his whole house, basically all of his wealth, all his property, everything, were given to Esther. She's queen. Did she really need it? No. But it was definitely showing, the king was showing, basically, that he sided with Esther and wanted to do anything to please her. The interesting thing with all this is, what does Esther do with all of that? She gives it to Mordecai. I think that's a pretty cool thing there. The king took, or actually the signet ring, actually what I wanted to hit first, the signet ring, that power that Haman had, basically, is given to Esther, and she gives it to Mordecai, and then she sets Mordecai over the house of Haman. This is, again, a good indicator of Esther's character. Esther started out as an orphan taken in by Mordecai. When this whole, the book of Esther starts out, it's Mordecai looking out for Esther, looking out for her best interests, walking by the gate, checking up on her, even when she gets pulled into this, looking for a new king queen contest. And here, Esther repays all of that kindness. She gives all that the king gave her to Mordecai to do what he sees best. She's the queen. She doesn't need money. She's got power. She doesn't need any of that as well. And she knows that Mordecai will do the best with what has been given to her. All the power that used to reside in Haman now resides in Mordecai. Life can change fast is really what this is to look at. And we're not really to assume anything as we go through this life. How did Mordecai achieve his greatness? It was his character. It was who he was. And eventually that came out. He just did the right thing day in and day out. And somebody who does that, God can do great things with. Zechariah 4:10, who's despised the day of small beginnings? If you are faithful in the little things, you might never be CEO of a major company. You might never be president. You might never win the Super Bowl. But you know what? If you have a family, your kids are watching you. I mean, there's a reason that that's a qualification for elders. It's one of the hardest things I think to do. It's to get your kids into the kingdom of heaven. It's tough. It's a battle. I mean, but your family sees you day in and day out. So I don't know who you affect for Jesus Christ, but your family is a huge one, and it's a huge opportunity there. Being faithful in those little things, day in and day out. If you're faithful in the little things, God sees it. God saw the faith of Mordecai. God saw the faith of Esther. So even with all that happened, Esther didn't let it go to her head. She falls at her feet, where he once again extends the scepter. Character is where we are at all times. The next ask is really kind of a big ask. She's trying to get this whole decree that has been put out there, the destruction of the Jews. She's trying to get this reversed, appealed, repealed, something. Something to happen so the Jews don't get destroyed. Xerxes liked power. Let's read chapter verses 8 through the end of the chapter. But now, Xerxes talking here. Now you write to the Jews as you see fit in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked. So the king's tribes were called at that time in the third month, that is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governor, the princes, the province, which extended from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to every province according to its script, to every people according to their language, as well as the Jews according to the script and the language. He wrote the name of King Xerxes and sealed it with the king's signet ring and sent letters by couriers on horses riding on steeds served by the royal stud. And then the king granted Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and defend their lives, to destroy, kill, annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children, women, and to plunder their spoil. On one day in all provinces of King Xerxes, the 13th day of the 12th month, that is the month Adar, a copy of this edict to be issued as law in each and every province was published to all the people, so the Jews would be ready on this day to avenge themselves of their enemies. Couriers hastened and, impelled by the king's command, went out riding on the royal steeds, and the decree was given out at the citadel in Susa. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of golden garment of fine linen, purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For there was light and gladness and joy and honor. In each and every province and in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dead of Jews had fallen on them. So Xerxes, like I said, he liked power, but he wasn't always the greatest at governing. Back in chapter 3, he gave his power to Haman, and that's kind of how we ended up in this predicament to start, how we started getting into this predicament. I'm not sure if he realized that was a bad misstep or was just kind of lazy, but now he basically turns the whole kingdom over to Mordecai. He says, draft up a document, draft up something that will deliver your people, and I'll sign it. I trust you to figure this out. What does it take for a person who doesn't believe in God to change and repent, to submit their life totally to God and be immersed in water and receive God's Spirit? That takes a lot. We've all probably done that, talked to a relative, talked to a friend, talked to whoever, and they're predisposed on what they believe. They're locked in, and just getting them to change direction, it's hard. It is really hard. My mom, man, we took a lot of shots on my mom. Luke took some shots on my mom, you know, but she never did, never repented. Why? Because she'd been a Methodist for 40 years. And redoing that wiring, it didn't happen. What happens is we get pre-wired by our experiences, especially those in our younger years, to believe a certain way. That's why it's so hard to change someone who's a Catholic, a Mormon, or some other religious background to the gospel, especially when they get older. You know, they say, it doesn't feel right. It just doesn't feel good. I've had people say that to me. Yeah, it doesn't feel good because that's your emotions talking. You're wired to believe a certain way, and this is crashing in on your feelings and your emotions. No matter what the logic, their feelings will lead them astray. I bring this up because I think Xerxes is in this boat. Xerxes was pagan through and through. That's what he was. He served the flesh. His wealth and power, he got what he wanted. But even Xerxes, with all his powers and riches, I think he sees something greater is actually happening here. Something greater is happening behind the scenes. I'm not saying Xerxes was honest, but even he can see that something is happening here. And this is why he turns his control over to a Jew. He basically turns his whole kingdom over to a people that he was about to destroy. And that is really the power of God. Don't doubt what God can do. God, the book of Esther is a great example. Because you can take any of us and you can plug us in the book of Esther. Because nothing great happened. No fire from heaven, none of that. This is just events playing out, and we see a deliverance of a people. We see a man of power all of a sudden changing his direction. You know why? Through faith. That's really what it comes down to. God didn't do this with signs and wonders. He did it by nudging a few events and people and revealing the plans of the wicked. Psalm 146 says, he defends the fatherless and widows and thwarts the way of the wicked. There's a song with that. It's a funny song.
Kind of a question if you've ever thought of it. So it's interesting. So you mentioned that he's going to hand the kingdom over to Mordecai. And in verse 8, you read at the end, seal it with the king's signet ring so that it may not be revoked. So that's the same thing that happened to Daniel, right? Where the king's like, well, I don't really want to throw you in with the lions, but I have to. Because it was an edict among the Medo and Persian kings that once a king put it into law and put his signet ring on it, you couldn't revoke it, right? Yep. But yet here, it gets revoked. Have you ever thought about that before?
Was it really revoked? I take it more as before the Jews weren't able to defend themselves. Now he's saying, hey, you can still take on the Jews like I said before. But they can come back at you with all they got, and they can kill you legally. That's the way I've always read it. Does that make sense?
Yep. Yep. Great.
Okay.
Yep. Perfect. I mean, thanks.
Because you can't reverse this thing. It's done.
Yeah. The other thing that I always thought was really interesting that you said earlier is he has no idea this is even happening. You know, right? I mean, he's like, he doesn't know what he signed in, and I believe God did that on purpose, because what you're bringing out really well tonight is how God's allowing people to make these choices, and then he's working either through their faith or using them as an instrument of destruction and to bring about his plan, right? So I think that was all a part of it, that Haman in his sneakiness tried to sneak it in, but now the king's not sitting there trying to back up his words, because Esther comes up to him in verse 5 and says, if it pleases the king and I have found favor for him, the matter seems to the king I am pleasing his sight. Let it be written and revoke the letters devised by Haman. She doesn't say, hey, will you change your edict? She's like, will you overturn the sneaky thing that Haman did? And I always thought that was really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because he really can't, because that's the problem. But what he can do is he can put another one in that basically is going to make... Was there a hand up?
Yeah.
Oh. You don't put him up high enough, Mark.
So... could we agree that Haman weaponized the law against his opponents? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he totally manipulated the system and worked it to yeah. Yeah, use the legals.
Right, huh? The new, Solomon's right.
There is nothing new under the sun, yeah. If you're hinting at something, I agree. yeah, and that's what the wicked do. They try to find whatever way they can to persecute the righteous, persecute those who believe in truth. Haman did it back then, and people are doing it today. So, yeah, definitely right. All right, let me finish this up. Mordecai gets control of the kingdom. And so it was impossible for a decree, like we said, a decree to get reversed. Mordecai writes another decree. It says basically the Jews, they can defend themselves with full force. And it levels the playing field. Jews could be attacked, but they had every right to retaliate with everything they got. Is this really justice? You know, isn't God a God of love? Well, no, you know, what did God say under the old covenant? We'll go there for time, but if you strike one vice, I get to strike you back, life for life, tooth for tooth, however you want to put it that. And that was the law, and it wasn't so much about justice, but really, why was that in the law? Why was that in the Levitical law? If you strike me, I strike you back, I can strike you. It was basically, hey, don't do it, it's a bad idea. Don't go pick a fight, because they got every right to, you know, fight back at you. You know, and that's really, you know, it was to prevent stuff. It's the same way here. You know, if everyone was packing guns, we'd have a lot less violence. It's crazy how often we hear about, you know, the shootings and some of the, there was a goofy one that just happened, I think, today. It was at the celebration for the Kansas City Chiefs. Somebody got shot. I think that's right. No? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what happened. Isn't that stupid? It's a celebration. We killed somebody. And it's crazy. But again, we we live in a country where people don't expect that to happen, but if there was a little more martial law and people were persecuted, I think that a lot of that would drop quickly. That's why it was there under the Levitical law. Yeah. If you know I have the right to shoot you, if you come at me in my house, you're a lot less likely to do that. this is funny. I'll be done. I thought this just cracked me up. Self-driving cars. Obviously, I'm a geek, and so that stuff always interests me. So, Waymo makes self-driving cars. And no one probably saw this one coming. They make a self-driving car, and it was in San Francisco. I don't know exactly. No one really knows why, but it got downtown, and it has no driver, and a group of people surrounded it and destroyed it, lit it on fire. Like, so when you do that when you're self-driving car, how do you report that one? Your self-driving car, anyone's on route to pick you up and it burns up. It shows where our society really is. The Waymo car had nobody to come to its aid. We need to be able to come to our aid, and that's really why you strike me, I strike you. That's why that was there. That type of law is actually very effective. Like I say, in modern America, we don't see that. We see a lot of where the criminals have more rights than the victim. That type of system won't work. It doesn't work. It's not working. So God back then allowed people to defend themselves. Our founding fathers knew this. That's why we have the right to bear arms. So remember how this first edict ended in chapter 3, you know, when the king turned it over and let Haman sign that decree. I think Nolan was kind of indicating this, but that edict was a train wreck. This edict, how did it end? For the Jews, there was lightness and gladness, joy and honor. When righteousness comes through, good things happen. Every single time. But the wicked hate God so much, they try everything they can to extinguish it. The best thing mankind can do is serve God. But the wicked will always try to put it down. But as it gets darker, it just gives the light a better opportunity to shine. So, all righty. Finish her up next week.